From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 10th day of January 2025. It's USDA Report Day. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets and the reports with Mike Zuzlow. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Then we'll turn our attention to food and feeding programs in Los Angeles County as they are dealing with those catastrophic fires. I thought it might be interesting to hear how they go about flexing what is normally about a 900,000 people a month food and feeding program for the regional food bank to something much larger than that. And then as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast too. We'll do that with Eric Snodgrass of Conduit Ag here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn for the day settled at $4.70.5, up 14.5 cents. The May at $4.79.5, 15 higher, and new crop December at $4.50.25, 3.25 higher. March beans at $10.25.25, up 26.25. The May at $10.38, 27.25 higher, and November at $10.31, up 17.25 cents. Bean meal a dollar lower at $2.98.30. The bean oil at $45.58, up $2.82. Wheat futures soft red down 3.25 at $5.30.75 in the March. The hard red at $5.51.75, a penny and a half higher for the day. Live cattle futures were up $1.17.5. Feeders $1.10 higher, and the lean hogs up 77.5 cents. They finished at $82.55 for this Friday. Mike Zuzlow now joins us from GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Wow, what a busy day. Usually the January reports are busy, but this one had a whole lot going on in it. Some big changes. Can you start out by detailing some of those for me?
Yeah, you know, the biggest changes, Todd, and they were sorely needed because of the fact that we've continued to see the demand side of the equation really wobble here, whether it's the weekly export sales this morning having several marketing year lows, or whether it's China seeing 16-month lows in their currency, near record lows in their currency, and record lows in their bond yields with their deflationary pressures increasing. We really needed some supply to go along with the Argentine weather, and we got that in the form of the USDA coming in and changing the U.S. yield numbers in a big way, the corn taking it down 3.8 bushels to the acre. And so we're now dealing with a 1.54 billion bushel carryover, and we're dealing with stocks of just a little over 12 billion bushels as of December 1, about 100 million less than last year at this time. So supplies tightening dramatically again for what I think a third month in a row when you incorporate the world corn supply demand fundamentals. Beans saw a yield decline about an eighth, tenth of a bushel. We'll call it a bushel just to be nice, but that didn't do enough that we took the ending stocks down to 380 million bushels. And we did do enough to take the ending stocks globally from 131.9 down to 128.3. So we did lose a substantial amount of ending stocks in the beans. And as I say, there it was sorely needed because Mato Grosso is harvesting beans right now. And so I think we have, with these numbers in the row crops, a reason to really come back next week and look at that South American weather, which I think Argentina, specifically in the Pampas regions, and this is not just me saying this, but some of the South American colleagues I have, I'm saying it, we could be close to a 2012 type scenario for Argentina in terms of big irreparable yield damage being done in the next 10 days. So we're in a bona fide weather market after Friday's report, if you ask me.
I thought it was interesting as we watched the trade through the day that we haven't really had a big noon swoon for a while, but soybeans, they jumped there at 11 o'clock as the report came out and they saw that big drop in yield in the United States. And then they lost about half of their gains for the day, but they picked them all up again as we closed out the day. I suppose that's got to be a good sign for this marketplace.
Yeah, I think so. But I would say that the problem with the markets as we go into the weekend is that it's driven more by weather and supply, because the meal market is so sick looking. And unfortunately, the wheat market is so sick looking. And the winter wheat seedings, while not burdensome, they were above the average trade guess. by a little under 1 million acres. It did not surprise me. I'd had a lot more clients going after more soft red and hard red wheat. I was at 34.3 all winter wheat, and USDA came in at 34.1. But we're not getting anything in terms of supportive fundamentals in the meal and the wheat. And the most disturbing fact of the close on Friday for me was we're still near the 2024 lows in meal. It needs to be the leader of the upside for the soy complex. And we've got a wheat corn spread now that is the lowest since, I think, June of 2023. And we went through 80 cents, and we're now in the 60s as far as where we're at on the soft red minus the corn, hitting 60 cents, maybe closing below 60. And again, that takes you back to the June, July time period of 2023. Wheat is now a feed grain. Southeast Asia is treating it like that, with more reports that feed wheat is being bought instead of feed corn.
Yeah. So is that just a global perspective that it will be feed wheat, or will there be feed wheat fed in the United States too?
I think feed wheat will be fed in the United States if we come out of the winter with ample moisture levels. I don't think we're there yet, although I did see feed and residual for corn, I think, did drop by USDA. But as we know, that's kind of the leaky hole in the bucket. It's the whatever's left over type number. So it's not really a representation of actual feed demand. It's more of a residual demand, if you ask me.
Can you turn your attention to the consumption numbers just a bit and run through those? Maybe start with any changes. And I don't think there were for soybeans to speak of. Residual, a million, not very much.
Total demand stayed at about 4.35 billion, Todd. The USDA kept the exports unchanged at 1.825. We saw a little bit of decline in corn and wheat imports for China. The market was ready for that, I think. As far as the corn side of the equation goes on the demand and consumption side, we did see a pullback in, as I say, the feed and residual. The ethanol number remained at 5.5 billion. Exports were trimmed just a little bit, like 25 million bushels. Worldwide, though, the total consumption went up. And so the world stocks to use ratios really took a pretty decent nosedive in the corn by seeing both reduced supply and increased demand. That was a surprise to me. I think this is where the corn market, if you would have asked me before the report, could it go by itself higher after the report comes out? I would have said not without the market getting fed as far as the bull getting fed. We got the bull fed through the beans, but we also got the bull fed through the corn outright. So we are now back within about a penny of the 2024 high now in lead month corn, that 473 and a half area. That's going to be a big number for me next week.
Yeah. Speaking of the global numbers, no changes for Argentina or Brazil as it relates to soybeans. On the global side, was there much of a change in either corn, soybeans, or wheat in total?
No, not much, especially in the South American side of the equation. I went back and looked at the 23-24 for Argentina and Brazil when it came to the corn, especially because I still think Brazil is a lot tighter in corn. And their prices are suggesting that. The Brazilian corn price has been going steadily higher here the last month and a half, or since the new year. So I feel like that overall, that's another key element to watch here, is if we are near a 2012 drought situation on hitting the yield very hard for corn in Argentina, and it being the big product exporter, number one meal exporter in the world, you would think corn and meal cash prices in South America would really start to react to that. So that's a real big piece of the puzzle too.
Thank you much. I appreciate it.
You too, Todd. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. That is Mike Zuzulo. He's with GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Given the wildfires in Los Angeles, I thought it might be interesting to talk with somebody about food and feeding programs and how they respond during catastrophes. I called and spoke with David May. He's at the LA Regional Food Bank. I asked him first to tell me a little bit about how many meals or people they service in a given month.
The Los Angeles Regional Food Bank on average reaches about 900,000 people every month through our direct distribution programs and through our partner agency network. In order to distribute food locally in LA County, which is, of course, very large, we partner with about 600 other nonprofit organizations that might be churches or synagogues or mosques or non-religious organizations like YMCA and Boys and Girls Club. And those organizations help us to provide food to local communities from our large distribution centers. We have one in South Los Angeles and then another one in the City of Industry.
So now let's turn our attention to the issues of the day, the catastrophic events that are taking place in Los Angeles County at this point, the fires there. How does the food bank support the area and its needs, which are different, relatively speaking, than your everyday food and feeding programs?
Right. So one thing that is helpful in situations like this, in a very unfortunate situations like this, is that we do have the pipeline and the apparatus and everything set up to deploy food relatively quickly throughout LA County. So some of what that looks like from a disaster response perspective is increasing the inventory to our partner agencies that are in affected areas or serving people in affected areas. There's also oftentimes in emergencies like this, and we saw this early in the COVID-19 pandemic as well, opportunities for the mobile food pantry program that I described a minute ago to set up in disaster response locations and provide additional supplemental food assistance there. We're also just a resource. For example, LAUSD is closed right now. Their website is linking to us for families who need groceries or supplemental food items to help with food assistance for their families. And then, of course, we remain very connected to government and local organizations, and we can provide food assistance in bulk where needed, wherever government or other nonprofit organizations need it. For example, we're getting a lot of water right now that we're trying to deploy into the affected areas.
How do you flex from 900,000 a month to whatever this larger number must be at this point?
Yeah, the way that we organize our operations is so that it is scalable. And what that means is, for example, before the pandemic, we were reaching about 300,000 people every month. At the worst part of the pandemic, it was about 1.1 million. Then it came down for a little while to about 800,000. And then before the end of 2024 was already, consistently, in fact, really through most of 2024, was up to an average of 900,000 people every month. So we'll see what the numbers are after this emergency related to the greater Los Angeles wildfires. But what we essentially do is scale more food resources through the pipelines that we have established and through the distribution channels that we have established already. We just increase that volume and then direct people to the food assistance as necessary. So we are able to scale. It seems like, it's devastating, the experiences that many people are going through right now. But we're doing everything that we can to scale up food assistance into the community and make sure people are getting that nutritious food, water, and other household items.
Whose shoulders do you tap on at this point in time for help? Do you tap on organizations, individuals? How do you provide the greater amount of food that's needed? Because it's either donated or you have to purchase one of the two.
Yeah, we're fortunate that we live in a generous community, and we're as devastating as a lot of the images that we're seeing in the media are. We're so grateful to the people that have reached out to provide assistance. We see support from different local organizations, but in this case also national organizations who want to provide donated food items, who are providing financial support, people coming in with extra volunteer support. So those are all important ways that people get involved. We, of course, prioritize relationships with our corporate sponsors and corporate partners, as well as with local government officials and of course, the many individuals that reach out to us and want to get involved and be part of that solution.
What do you need most at this point?
Right now, at our primary distribution centers, we're collecting shelf-stable items as far as food donations. The easiest way for people to get involved is to go onto the website and make a financial contribution. That allows us to be flexible about how we deploy resources, and it allows us to be really nimble in our response. But for some people, financial donation isn't possible, so they want to make a food donation, or maybe they want to come in and volunteer. All of those are great ways to support the community at this time. And of course, there are many other nonprofit organizations doing work and addressing other parts of the emergency too. But if you're passionate about food assistance and responding in that way, then volunteering and providing a financial or food donation to the food bank is what's most helpful.
Do they do that directly through the LA Food Bank, Regional Food Bank, or can they do it through Feeding America or other places?
Wherever people feel kind of pulled, we're happy at the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank, and this emergency really is affecting LA County right now. We're happy to have people come to lafoodbank.org and find out about the many ways people can get involved, especially if you're talking about volunteering. You know, we're going to be able to coordinate that a lot more directly. But we also, you can donate directly to our 600 partner agencies. So these are separate nonprofit organizations that are active in the community. And if you're passionate, for example, about a specific part of LA County, then you may find a local partner agency of ours to donate to. If you're passionate about helping everyone in LA County, then we direct people towards us. And then if you're interested in food insecurity at the national level, and you know, it's an ongoing issue for many people, whether there's an emergency or not. And then Feeding America is a great organization. And of course, we're a partner food bank of Feeding America. And we're excited to have support in at any level and any way that it can come in.
Thank you, David, and good luck with your endeavors to feed those in need there in LA County.
Yeah, well, we really appreciate you helping to raise awareness too.
You're welcome. David May is with the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. I spoke with him earlier today about how the food bank manages to flex as there are catastrophes unfolding in its area. Now let's turn our attention to the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass. He's at Conduit Ag. Hello, Eric. Thank you much for being with us. As you know, we just finished up an interview with the folks at the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. They're worried about, I guess, the Santa Ana winds out there. I suppose that works into the story you've been trying to tell us about dry conditions.
Right. So if you think back to the narrative we've carried for most of this fall and now winter, it's been the drought that's been in the Sun Belt that's extending across parts of the Southwest that gets all the way into Mexico. And that's been my story. It's there now. Could it creep north, invade more of the plains and Corn Belt by the time we get to summer? And that's been our biggest worry, right? So that's why I've been saying, hey, watch the ocean temperatures. They're often a precursor to this, especially the Gulf of Alaska going cold. Watch La Nina and pay close attention to the Bermuda High. So it's all one bigger story. But what happened was last week for 2.5 days, we saw high pressure build into the Great Basin. The flow comes over the Mojave Desert and then goes over the San Gabriel Mountains where it descends and compressionally warms. And as it does so, the humidity levels drop down to like 1 to 5% on 80 mile an hour winds. And we saw absolutely horrific Santa Ana wind wildfires in that area. And they continued even until today. And there's even worry that next week, early next week, maybe on Tuesday, we could see a similar setup, not quite as powerful and strong as the one we just had, but they're not done with this yet. And we still don't even have numbers, I think, on just how much property was destroyed. And clearly, we don't know how many people have been killed or are still missing. So this was a pretty tragic event. And it is the same storm system, by the way, that stranded me yesterday in Texas because they shut down Dallas-Fort Worth on snow. And now today, Atlanta is almost shut down. Most of the cancellations are coming out of Atlanta because we have a snowstorm that was far enough to the south to impact, you know, the mid-south all the way over to the southeast after dumping on parts of Texas and Oklahoma. So Todd, the whole point behind all of this is that may be indicative of where the remainder of this winter is going to go. And that's going to be important for next year. So I think starting off there was a wise choice.
Next year, you mean next growing season in the United States, right? So tell me
about
that.
That's right. Well, so here's the thing. We could have plenty of snow this winter here. In fact, as I'm talking to you right now on Friday afternoon, it's snowing in our hometown of Mahomet and all around this whole area. And we're actually getting more snow out of this, it feels like, here at least, than we got out of the system earlier this week. Now, parts of central Illinois got hammered by the snowstorm earlier this week. Some places picking up 8 to 10 to 12 inches of snow. And of course, that's the one that shut down Kansas City. Now, here's my thing, though, Todd. There is water in this soil, but not, or excuse me, in this snow, but not much. And I accidentally said soil in there because I'm thinking about how we still have trapped below the frost layer, some drier soils down low. And I talked to some farmers back earlier this week. I was with Arlen Suderman, actually, and we were asking growers, do any of you in Iowa and Illinois and Indiana have tile running? And now a lot of them were from northern Illinois and northern Indiana and all over Iowa, but the answer was no. And he showed them the soil moisture maps, and even though we've got moisture right now in this snow, it is not able to be used. And so this just comes back to, again, this narrative that there is increased risk, not guaranteed, but increased risk of drought issues in 2025. And if they're going to start to spread from somewhere, it's going to be out of the plains, either the northern plains or the southern plains into the Sun Belt and into Mexico. And this La Nina, which is likely at its peak, is a kind of a part of that problem with making the atmosphere reluctant to retrieve moisture to hit some of those really dry areas. So Todd, that's one big long breath, but me telling you that some of the narrative you and I have been talking about all these Fridays for the last couple of months continues to play out. And by the way, we've got more cold and snow on its way. But remember, it's snow that happens in March that is more critical to our soil moisture than snow that happens in January.
Indeed. Can you tell me, what is it that changes this narrative for you? What would be, what happens?
So what needs to happen is that the jet stream needs to become, like, I guess the right word or phrase is multidimensional. It's one dimensional right now, which means we've got one piece that's diving into Canada, ripping across the country with no strong, what we call subtropical component. That would be the component that goes from Hawaii into Southern California and Mexico and then races off to Maine. So one of the reasons why California has been able to have such horrific wildfires and stay so dry in its southern half is there's no second dimension to the jet stream, which would be coming out of the south. El Nino years, we have that. And that's why last winter was wet. That's why last winter was mild. That's why last spring was so wet. We're now in a different regime. It's a La Nina. At times, the waters in the Gulf of Alaska have been cold. The momentum has been all over the place in the atmosphere. So despite us seeing snow here right now, it's dry. You know, so that's, I think, the big implication we have. We just need to understand if this carries through the remainder of winter, because I expect winter to stay active and cold. No doubt about that, I think, in the near term especially. But the question is, what good is it going to be if we can't maintain the moisture into spring and summer of this year, Todd, this growing season?
30 seconds on Argentina. Will they get rain?
So there have been some embedded thunderstorms in the interior of Argentina during this whole drought building episode. And most of the drought is in Santa Fe, Entre Rios, down to Buenos Aires. I don't know if that's a large enough area to offset some of the much bigger yields in Brazil, which it's extremely wet in the center west region. Here's the end point. If this continues past the 25th of January, if we're still talking it past the 25th of January, I think we start seeing some yield loss there.
Thank you much.
You bet.
Eric Snodgrass is with Conduit Ag. Joined us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It comes to you from Illinois Public Medium. It is public radio for the farming world, online on demand at willag.org. Stay with us if you can. Many of these radio stations will carry our Commodity Week program. Otherwise, you'll hear it over the weekend or online now at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason.